He's still around.
Yes, and I've met him a couple of times, talked to him.
He went from being a kind of a intellect, literary creature, to, you know, be himself an artist. And he became very self-concerned and verbose and rather...
You mean aggressive?
Too much for me.
Yeah, aggressive, would you say?
Yes, at least aggressive.
An intellectual thug.
Boring.
Boring. Boring.
Boring. Boring, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to go to small claims court in 5 or 6 years ago in downtown New York City. And I'm waiting in line for my case, and there's this guy hogging the whole scene. He's up in front of the bench. He's at a table. He's got all these documents. And he's berating, Con Ed, or what's the telephone company in New York City? I don't know, whatever it was at that point.
It was Bell.
Yeah. He's berating, Verizon. I think it was Verizon.
Oh, that's much more recent. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking 2003, 2004. And he's berating. He's berating the whole court, and how he's personally being harassed by Verizon, and he has all these bills and things, and he refused to pay the bills, and he had this whole case, and he goes on and on and on, and really, a very well-researched guy for his case. Most people wouldn't be doing what he's doing. They just meekly present a few arguments. But this, he went on for a long time. And I don't know if I recognized him then, but after, when we were finished, I was leaving, and this guy's walking out, and I said, oh, that's Richard Castellanos. I saw his profile. So we walked home from the court that night and got up to date. And what I liked about him is that he liked Ben Watson's book on Frank Zappa, which a lot of people thought was ridiculous. But Richard appreciated. He did a compendium reader on Zappa, and he included, I think, Ben's stuff. So I liked his mind, and we were going to do something, but it filtered away. He got too busy trying to survive. You know, he had to keep doing collections and anthologies to...
He doesn't have a problem surviving. He inherited money.
Oh, okay. Well, he seemed to overwork.
His uncle, you know, was a famous conductor.
Castellanos. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He has a sister too. She used to work at Mama. They don't speak anymore. He doesn't speak to her. He's a little bit of a nut job.
Right. She used to work at
Mama. I'm sorry about it. He would like to be. He would like for us to be closer, but I just can't take it.
Right. He promoted you. He in some book mixed.
Oh, the book was one. He did a wonderful chapter on it.
Yeah, mixed media.
No, he was completely different in those years.
Yeah, that's 40 years ago.
Yeah, he was really very. Normal is a terrible word, but he's not anymore. The number of people turn into that kind of self-characterization. Douglas Davis is another one.
Yes, I've met Davis. You remember his mid-90s internet project of having this thing go around the world and everybody typing into it or something? You remember that?
Yeah, I brought him down to Venezuela and he did one part of that thing there.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he used to be a friend of mine too, but he turned into impossible. He's living in the old Fluxus apartment.
Yeah, they seem to be stuck in an image of culture of the 60s and 70s, and they can't get tuned in.
Douglas has had two concussions.
Oh.
And so that's partly, I think, what happened to him.
What did you say, that Richard's sister worked with Mama, or you said something about Mama?
She worked at Mama at the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay.
Oh, years ago.
Okay,
very nice lady.
All right, so in this booklet, there's an essay by Richard Castellanos, published in December of 67. And I want to read some parts of it, because, you know, it is a good essay.
You mean the thing that was in Harper's?
It was in Harper's?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know if it says, seen and not heard. And seen is S-C-E-N-E, and heard is H-E-R-D. And, okay, so this is from Harper's. It says, USCO, those mysterious initials that magisterially appear in various places and contexts signify Us Company, or Company of Us, a collective of artists who operate out of a forsaken church in Garnerville, New York, about an hour north of New York City. USCO functions as a frame, as well as a signature for individual artists who move in and out, contributing to the collective effort and yet preserving their personal identities. The quickest measure of USCO's impact is the relation between its age and achievement. The quickest measure of USCO's impact is the relation between its age and achievement. For in less than 4 years, it has completed a multiplicity of projects and established an international reputation. The core members of USCO are its founders, a painter in his late 20s named Steve Durkee, a younger man with a considerable aptitude for electronics, Michael Callahan, and a 38-year-old poet who had occasionally plied conventional trades, Gerd Stern. Their paths crossed in the early 60s as they helped each other with their respective works. Durkee remembers, Gerd was living near here, and he was just turning his poetry into on-the-wall objects. As I had been making objects on the wall for a long time, I helped him. Since I understood that very thoroughly, he was able to say X, Y, and A, and I was able to say A, B, and Z. That was how the relationship started. End of quote. A short while later, Stern, then in San Francisco, needed some technical help in making a tape collage, and Michael Callahan, as a technician at the local tape music center, became his collaborator. Not until 1964, however, did they all gather in Durkee's studio home, the Garnerville Church, to combine their collaborative instincts into USCO. Now, Gerb, I'm reading this into the record because not many people are going to see this article, and it's good to get it on the tape. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Okay, he continues. As each moved out of his respective art into collective work, the results of their collaboration became intermedia hyphenated, works that straddled the walls which traditionally divided one art from another. USCO has produced objects of all sorts, posters as well as machines, but their primary medium has been the theatrical event. Some have been conventional performances where an audience arrived at a certain time, paid an admission price, and then took their seats. But USCO prefers to work in what Stern calls, quote, the environmental circumstance, where, quote, you take a space and an open-ended piece of time and you see what you can make it do to people, what you can massage people, unquote. I'm saying the massage part. In producing an environment, USCO metaphorically creates a world of activity, just as Durkee adds, God created the universe, unquote. The best USCO theatrical pieces contain a plethora of communicative stimuli, slides, films, sometimes looped, colored, and or pulsing lights, sounds, objects, and even odors, all of which usually function to evoke archetypal themes. A particularly successful piece they characterize as a beautiful mix. That's in quotes, beautiful mix. Did you put odors in these things, these environments?
Oh, we tried it once or twice. It was just a kick, you know. I think, you know, we used incense and
incense
other stuff.
Yeah. The four-room environment USCO constructed at the Riverside Museum in May 66 was probably their most elaborate and brilliant exhibition. USCO designed this system, in quote system, to be a meditation room full of basic symbols and materials, male and female, heartbeats, and above seven spheres representing the seven planets. Durkee remembers we also had five elements. We had sand in the box in the middle, fire in the candles. We had air. We had water in the fountain around the periphery of the column, which was also the lingam inside the yoni, a psychosexual situation. There was an Om tape playing on a stereo tape recorder. Have you heard of Om? Dome, home, womb, tomb, bomb. The Om is in a lot of important things. Om was the original sound of the universe. What we had in that room, in short, was everything that is. Unquote. Most of USCO's oldest admirers consider the Riverside Museum display its greatest single work, and the exhibition has been memorialized in Judd Yalcott's color film, Down by the Riverside, 1966. The effect of an USCO environment is somewhat similar to the psychedelic experience. In both, an awareness of sensory overload disrupts all attempts at concentrated focus, and also initiates a gamut of emotional and psychological changes. An intrinsic purpose of such an environment is the challenging of linear habits of organization. Now, I would say we may not have needed that challenge of linear habits in the long run, since nobody can read anymore due to the McLuhan environment that came. You know what I mean? Now, is our books worth preserving? Anyways, so continuing the article, quote, and this is Gert Stern talking, we're dealing with the question of how you can get into the mind with information and images and whether literary sequential ordering is really the only decent, rational, and reasonable input. That's what I just brought up as a question, Stern remarks. Therefore, the connection with psychedelics, while valid, does not explain everything. Although Durkee once extensively lectured on the new drugs, which he has since given up, Usko's pieces are designed to turn people on, not to themselves, but each other. Their principal theme, Durkee says, quote, is that we are all one. Once we have the understanding that you're not threatening to me and I'm not threatening to you, in other words, that you are myself outside of myself, then we can begin to work together, unquote. Usko's environments present a field of elemental images precisely to make everyone undergo a common reception and then experience a shared awareness. Indeed, their conception of art's possible purposefulness evokes echoes of the American 30s, but the content of Usko's message is more ecumenical than parochial. The close connection between... Now, this is December 67. Costellanis does a good article on McLuhan for the New York Times in maybe January 67. A very good article, long article, and he has some good quotes by McLuhan. One of them was that concrete poet was nursery stuff, childish stuff. That was McLuhan commenting on concrete poetry, which Costellanis maybe was into then, but he eventually becomes a concrete poet, right?
Yes.
Agree with that?
Absolutely.
So
he has some of my work in one of his concrete poetry books.
Right, and he did a Beyond Something. He did a good book around that time, 67, 68, interviews with all kinds of thinkers, McLuhan and probably Bucky Fuller and everybody, and that was a good collage. I think it was Beyond Either Or, maybe, something like that.
I don't know. I have one of a book of his of interviews of which, you know, one chapter is about Usko.
Right, but that's the one called Theater of Mixed Means or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
No, this was a...
Later.
Which, yours?
No.
Yeah, yours is like 66, 67, I think. It's about 68. It's a, a hardback done for a major publisher.
The Theater of Mixed Means is a hardback for a major publisher also.
Right, I have a copy of it. It's like white. It's paperback-ish. Maybe I got the paperback version.
Yeah, no, I have the hardback.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, he was young, and he got published very early.
Yeah, he knew a lot of people. He had a good contact structure. I mean, it wasn't until he got sort of wacky that people he was just too much for everybody.
Right, and so you're saying that through his uncle, he got early connections.
No, his father was
connected.
Something or other.
Okay.
No, money. There was
right.
Money in the family.
Okay, so that's how he could be so young and get into...
but he's always had enough money to support himself.
Right, so he can get around and have time to interview people and make connections and then get in New York Times.
Yeah.
The wiki, I'll look that up in a minute, is his birthday. He's probably born in the 40s, early 40s. Okay, so anyway, he continues the article because he knows McLuhan's work. He says, the close connection between electronic media and shared awareness has McLuhan-ish overtones. And sure enough, McLuhan's ideas are conspicuously among Usko's influences. Back in 1960, gives a date here, Garrett. Garrett Stern read an early draft on understanding media in the form of a report McLuhan submitted to the National Association of Educational Broadcasters in 1959. Now, that thing is not published till 61, 62, so it may not be till 62, technically, when you read this thing. Because in 67, if McLuhan gave Castellanos, the bibliography, it would have dated the report in 1960, but technically I don't think it was handed in then, but you couldn't have read it, because the one I have is, unless, you know, John Cage had a Xerox of some original copy that McLuhan handed in. So
I don't know. Supposedly Marshall sent it to Cage.
Right. And it could have been the copy of...
Well, it couldn't have been much of it. I don't know, man.
Well, I have it right here.
It's
the report, and it says...
No, I'm just telling you that my idea of dates is not reliable.
Right.
Michael Callahan is very good about dates. But, I mean, since I was in San Francisco for at least 6 months before Who Are You and What's Happening.
Yeah, so that's in 63, and so you're reading this in 62.
I probably read it in 62 or late 61 or something like that, but it wasn't 60 for sure.
Right, because this is the what University of Microfilms in Ann Arbor, Michigan gives you, and the report is dated June 30th, 1960. Now, Marshall would have sent this in, and he may have made a Xerox for Cage, and you would have gotten it.
I don't know.
But anyways, you didn't read it till 61, 62. We can say that, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, the article continues saying that...
I can't remember when the newspaper strike was in New York.
Right, we looked that up. No, we talked about that in earlier sessions.
Because it was before that.
That you read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not too long, maybe 3 or 4 months before that.
Yeah, we... okay. We looked that up in a previous session. The date's back there in the hours before. And that was like 62 or something. Anyways, and that experience persuaded reading that report that McLuhan submitted to the National Association of Education Broadcasters in 59. He probably didn't submit it till June 60. And that experience persuaded Stern to consider the artistic potential of the new media. Soon after, his own poetic impulses took off from the problems of black words on white paper and were channeled into tape collage. McLuhan himself has joined Usko for two performances, speaking after and sometimes before, and mixed media presentations. Are you laughing?
Well, it was more than the Usko joint.
Yes.
McLuhan, and the first one was pre-Usko. You know, that's the problem with articles, you know, or anything, because you tell somebody something, and then they shift it just a little bit, and it brings the whole thing out of phase.
Yeah.
And then you say to yourself, Jesus, you know, that's what happened. I told you what happened in Berlin, right?
Yes.
McLuhan thing.
Well, just mention a bit again. I don't know if you did. You might.
Well, it was the Replays conference, and first there was a panel about Nine Evenings, which a friend of mine, Robin Oppenheimer, gave a paper. But there were all these people, I mean, hundreds of people in the audience and maybe 12 people up on stage, panelists. And of all those people, I was the only one who had been at Nine Evenings, right? I wasn't the panelist, I was in the audience, and I realized, and they were basically saying it was a failure. And now, I was pissed, as I think I told you, because we weren't included, because we weren't part of the clique, but I didn't think it was a failure, I thought it was a success. I got up and I said that, you know. Now, the next day is the McLuhan panel, and there are all these people talking about Marshall, and the audience is asking, you know, acting like they're smart too. And I'm only the only person in the room that ever knew Marshall, you know. And I get up and I say some things because their ideas I thought were outré, you know, and off the mark. And who, I mean, the influences are so obvious, you know, whether it's Wyndham Lewis or James Joyce, or
Moholy Nagy. He was a big influence.
And also, what's his name? The art writer.
Gombrich.
Gombrich.
Yeah.
Now they were more into Innes than Gombrich.
Yeah.
But Gombrich was very important.
Oh yeah. No, big deal.
So I said, you guys, you know, are you know, kind of third party conversation. and you got to realize that there's still first party people in the world.
Yeah, and you're listening to one right now.
But did
that attract any attention? Did anybody come over?
A little bit. I mean, I think I told you that afterwards this woman came up to me, and she was the Canadian cultural person at the Canadian embassy, and
yeah.
She told me that they have a McLuhan
room.
No, it's not a room. It's a McLuhan. Wow. It's more than a room. It's not a... What was it? McLuhan.
Archive, or...?
No, it's a room, but there's a better word. You know, a more prestigious word. Salon.
Okay, now what was the Nine Evenings? I forget. What was that?
Nine Evenings was EAT, you know, experiment.
Oh, that. I've seen footage of that. Yes.
Yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
Don Thiel was part of that. He was there for that. And
really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I saw it at the Whitney a few years ago. A fantastic footage of the whole thing.
Yeah,
E.A.T.
Yeah, well,
Rauschenberg was part of it, right?
Yeah, Rauschenberg was a big part of it. His whole clique was it.
Right, I
forget. Page, Rauschenberg, Merce Cunningham. But the leader of it was a guy from Bell Labs, because it was a collaborative effort between Bell Labs engineers and artists.
Yeah, in the documentary they had footage of the guys, the high-tech guys up in the back, you know, modulating the whole thing.
Yeah, well...
So this came up in the
panel. There was just one evening about it. Yes, it's a famous event.
Yeah, were you there at the event?
Yes.
And so you're telling these people about what their understanding of is way off?
Well, the newspaper critics were, and the magazine critics were very critical, because, you know, there were tech problems, as
yes.
they usually are in experimental. And they were, you know, from a performance standpoint, they weren't, you know, kind of dramatic, huge successes. I mean, they were experiments in art and technology.
And there was a big crowd there in the documentary.
Yeah, there was a big crowd there, but, big. I think they had fairly full houses.
Yeah.
It was Nine Evenings, and it was heavily publicized. And Bell Labs put quite a lot of money into it. And, and Rauschenberg. And all those people were not poor, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Rauschenberg got good money for his paintings even then.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. And Jasper Johns.
And there's another guy who Don worked with, Bud or Butcher. I'll have to look up his name. When I say it, you'll recognize it, but I'll get that later. I just want to point out that the longest newspaper strike in U.S. history ended on April 1st, 1963. The nine major newspapers in New York City had ceased publication over 100 days before. That's the strike you're talking about, right?
The first day of that strike was the day that show opened at Allen Stone Gallery, and a few days later, Judy and I left for California.
Right, and so that would be late 62, early 63.
You're right.
Yeah. So...
You're right. So me reading McLuhan was at the most 6 months before that.
Right, so you're reading McLuhan on the drive across the country?
No. About 6 months before the show opened.
Right, you're in San Francisco when you're reading it?
No, I'm in Rockland County because MC Richards is right across the road from me, and she's the one who lends it to me.
Right, so that would
no,
be...
I didn't get to keep it.
Right, but you're reading it at the time of the newspaper strike. That's what you put...
No, I'm reading it about somewhere between 4 and 6 months before the first day of that strike.
Ah, okay, so you definitely read it in 62 then. Because
okay.
The strike starts at the end of 62, I think, but I might get a chance to look
okay.
it up.
All right.
So, okay, so the article should say, back in 62, Gerstern read an early draft. It says 1960.
Yeah.
And then it says, McLuhan joined us, go for two performances.
What happened is, I told you that Alvin Balkind called me and said he'd been at Who Are You and What's Happening, and he said, I noticed that you have influenced a lot by McLuhan. Isn't that true? And I said, yes. And he said, well, McLuhan is coming to lecture here. And I can't remember, it was 3 or 4 weeks later. And would you come up and do another version of your performance at the same time? And you could also show some of those pieces that you had at the museum in our gallery. I said, sure. And that's how we met McLuhan for the first time.
Right, and he was not part of the Esco performance, he just parallel to it.
He was speaking. He was there first. He was out first.
Yeah.
We joined it. And the second time, it was in Rochester.
But you were talking to him around then.
You mean after
corresponding,
Vancouver.
I mean. Maybe you started...
Oh, after Vancouver, we were in touch, yes.
Yeah, and then so Rochester happened, and that was, it was not a, did he say, oh, I'll come and be with you, or you just...
No, I think it was some kind of a thing where we were on the same program.
Yeah, someone else.
But that's what I mean. You talk that, you say that very consciously to somebody like Richard, but then he puts joined USCO, which is the wrong.
Yeah.
What is joined, the verb? Or is it another part of speech? But it's the wrong part of speech.
Yeah. Okay. Looking at the what I've got so far, the New York newspaper strike is 1962 to 63, and so we're talking late 62 is when the strike starts, and you have read the thing in early.
A good 6 months before that, maybe. But anyway, let's go on to the
okay.
Next.
So he says. McLuhan himself has joined Esco for two performances, speaking after and sometimes before a mixed media presentation. That's sort of, he said speaking after, sometimes before, but not joined. Esco concurs with his prophecy that today's cities will soon disintegrate into small communities, electronically interconnected. And from him, they also recognize how sensory overload in their home environment could recircuit their own sensibilities. That has a quote from Durkee. When you live in a 24-channel system, day in and day out, as we did when we were doing our things at home, running them for 24 hours a day almost, just get the rest of Durkee judges, you can become pretty much omnia-attentive. From McLuhan, along with the Indian aesthetician Ananda K. Kumaraswamy, that's true, right? That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
They took the theme that the contemporary artist should be as anonymous as the medieval artist. But interpretations of anonymity, in quotes, create a constant argument within the USCO house. Their work is clearly anonymous in the sense that it contains neither an individual signature nor earmarks of personalized expression. However, to Stern, their impersonal result does not deny individual artistic contributions. Esco has done so many things in its short life that future historians will have difficulty collecting all the data. What I list below is merely a rough summary of their produce. 1. Psychedelic posters and other graphics. 2. Various kinds of machines and electronic devices such as strobe lights and programming units. 3, electronic audiovisual aids such as a counting unit for the New York production of Norman Mailer's The Deer Park. 4, mixed means presentations for corporation sales conferences. 5, the setting up and operation of a mixed media discotheque. 6, kinetic artistic dash informational displays such as a much appreciated media mix about the Lower East Side for New York's Jewish Museum. And this autumn, that would be in 68, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. Or maybe he means this autumn, just past, December, fall of 67. 7, miscellaneous sound and light effects for all kinds of hippie and pacifist benefits. 8, theatrical performances in dozens of museums and universities. 9, an elegant kinetic meditational tabernacle in their own house. 10, the construction of a communal village in the New Mexican desert. 11, consultation in environment creation, including hyped-up rooms intended for psychiatric purposes. That would be the Murray thing, right?
No.
What?
No, that's the overstimulation environment at Albert Einstein Medical College in Philadelphia.
Okay, he's implying what you're going to be doing as intermedia, but maybe you haven't started it or aren't talking about it right then.
Which?
You know, this is December 67, and he's talking some of the stuff you did as intermedia, but he doesn't talk about intermedia. Maybe
no, I think Einstein was
right. It's
intermedia.
It's just before intermedia. So intermedia is happening right around the time this article is coming out. You're up in Boston, or it's starting in early 68. But that's a good inventory of what we've talked about through all these hours.
Yeah, very.
Then he says, the more Osco does, the further from convention it goes. The more imitators they have, the stronger their desire to move beyond even media mixes. They will probably move out of quasi-art objects and even theatrical displays into larger, more comprehensive creations. Quoting Stern, if we are concerned environmentally, we might as well plan our own environment. End of quote. The New Mexico project will be their first attempt at building a human community from scratch. Home base for... Now, that's probably around the time you're getting a bit uptight about the whole art world and no money in it and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and you're thinking of
exactly.
And you probably said something like that to him, because he's kind of implying it there. Home base for Osco is still the one-time church in Garnerville, a rather large building. It has one huge room, which was formerly a workshop, but now houses the Tabernacle, in brackets 1966, a kinetic environment that Osco opens to the public every Sunday afternoon. A hexagon, about 12 feet in diameter, the Tabernacle has such a rich gallery of sensory effects that the experience of sitting in it confirms Stern's promise that, quote, the Tabernacle stimulates people, shows them things they haven't seen before, makes them contemplative, unquote. All receipts from Osco activities go into maintaining the establishment, purchasing new supplies for pieces, and transportation. The telephone rings a lot, and a collective passion for long-distance conversation earns Mother Bell several hundred dollars each month. Osco's annual income runs about $30,000 per year, mostly from Maverick Systems Incorporated, a subsidiary in electronic manufacturing. As expenses invariably run more than income, donations fill the deficit. Stern says, we have all the same administrative problems of a small business and none of the conventional incentives, no fringe benefits and time off, unquote. The building itself has a legal identity in New York State as, quote, the Church of the Tabernacle Incorporated, whose, quote, ministers are Osco. To earn a tax-exempt free church status, Osco must keep the church's pews, which is to say the Tabernacle, open free to the public one day every week. So there was a tax write-off to have this open thing. You know what I mean? You're having the Tabernacle open free to the public. You have to do it to get your tax-exempt status.
that's a free church corporation under the laws of New York. We formed that sometime before we formed the Intermedia Foundation.
Right, but are you forming it to get the tax exempt status?
No.
Yeah, you're still going to do it anyways, right?
Whatever.
Okay.
The church thing worked, you know, for multi reasons.
Yeah.
To do with the spiritual nature of what we felt we were doing with the Tabernacle. But then Intermedia Foundation seemed like a better notice, so we formed that a little later, in 68.
Right, he says, within the shell of an old church thrives a new kind of religion as a new church, capital C, as a new church. The core members of USCO are hardly anonymous and amenable types. The core members of USCO are hardly anonymous and amenable types who could facilely blend into an organization, let alone a crowd. Yet their diversified talents and personalities make everyone, Stern insists, mutually supportive. About a dozen years ago, Stern had a reputation as an undistinguished poet on the fringe of the Beat Movement. He went to Black Mountain College for a spell. Now, that's a little off. It's implying, well, if you knew Black Mountain College happened before, and he met, oh no, it's sort of jumping back. Stern, about a dozen years ago, well, that would be 55, Stern had a reputation as an undistinguished poet on the fringe of the Beat Movement. He went to Black Mountain College for a spell, and he met both Allen Ginsberg and Carl Solomon in a psychiatric hospital in the late 40s. Born in 19... 19-
yeah, the Black Mountain was before that.
Yes. Well, that's what he's saying. Went to Black Mountain College for a spell, and he met both in a psychiatric hospital in the late 40s. That, if you know what the dates are, then it makes sense, but they might not. They might think it goes back to the psychiatric. Anyways, he says, born in 1928 in the Saar Basin, S-A-A-R-B-A-S-I-N, and a few years later, a refugee from Hitler's Germany, Stern came with his family to New York City in 1936 and later attended the Bronx High School of Science. He has worked as a carpenter, a mucker in a gold mine, a public relations executive, and a travel writer for Playboy. Now, that's pretty good stuff. We're bringing this out, but he had it in the article. To the USCO Division of Labor, GERD brings competencies developed in all these experiences. He is the poet and the carpenter, as well as the coordinator and the publicist. It is Stern who usually deals with the outside world, and perhaps because he's considerably older than his partners, he usually assumes the mediator's role in intra-USCO squabbles. Medium in height and build, he has an imposingly long, untrimmed, and unfurling reddish-brown beard, thick, unkempt black hair, and thick eyeglasses, which have a small reflecting disc at the zenith of their bridge. What's that? Is that a psychedelic touch?
Diffraction grating.
Ah. Is it zenith or zenith? I think it's zenith, right? When you pronounce
zenith.
It. Yeah. His appearance conveys a faintly Hasidic image which Stern sometimes cultivates. That'd be when the rabbi's around, right? Usually in demeanor, or when the rabbi is not around, you might do that. Usually in demeanor, he is disciplined and responsive, generous and practical. Then he describes Steve. Steve Durkee is so different from Stern that their relationship strikes some outsiders as an inexplicable puzzle. Born in 1938 in Warwick, New York, about 15 miles from Garnerville, he grew up in New York City, quit high school at 15, and soon embarked on a career as a painter. Some of his early work incorporated English words into an abstract field, and perhaps because he also lived near Robert, Indiana, Robert Rauschenberg, and Jim Rosenquist, the critic G.R. Swenson included Durkee in his pioneering survey of pop art in Art News magazine, September-October 63. So he's saying he got into the article because he lived near these guys. Objecting to this premature classification, Durkee abandoned that way of painting to concentrate on large, cleanly executed pattern paintings. In general, objective creations designed to induce subjective responses. Was he doing acid before that, or around that time?
No, not until mid-60s.
Okay. But he's doing objective creations designed to induce objective responses. That's about psychological effects, which you guys get into with...
But that was in the mid-60s since he started the blue paintings.
Oh, okay, yeah, because this is written in 67, right. In 1962, soon after their marriage, the Durkees purchased the abandoned church from a patriotic organization. What's that mean, patriotic organization? What would that be?
The
KKK?
No, it was either the Legion or the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Oh, okay. All right.
I think it was the Legion.
Right. He considers himself, so it flipped. It went from war guys into peace guys, right? He considers himself a follower of the mute Indian prophet, Maribaba, whom he calls the avatar of the age. The mute Indian prophet. And it was a personal directive from Baba himself that persuaded Durkee to terminate his use of psychedelic drugs. In Asko's work, he is not only the painter, but the ideologue and visionary. Statements of principle and ideals are almost his specialty. His appetite for mystical literature is almost scholarly. When presenting his ideas, he speaks with the surly intensity and commanding presence of an incipient prophet, which is what he does become that, right? As a Sufi.
Yep.
Next paragraph is on Michael. Michael Callahan is considerably younger than his partners, as well as possessed of distinctly different habits and competencies. Born in San Francisco in 1944, he joined Durkee and Stern at Garnerville just before his 20th birthday. Prior to that, he had attended San Francisco City College for nearly 2 years, intending to major in psychology. And he also helped design and construct the Bay City's first tape music center, eventually becoming its vice president. Was he his vice president by the time you meet him in 63, late 63? Or did he, like, you know, how did that happen?
I don't know.
Because he left with you pretty quickly.
No, not that quickly.
Oh, maybe a year or 2 years.
No, not that long, but around a year, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just a worker for this tape center.
No, he was the technical director, basically. He was the only technician they had. And they didn't know nothing about equipment.
So maybe he did become vice president before he left.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But no, I don't think he was when he and I were working.
Yeah. The son of an electrician, he learned precociously the languages of switches and circuits. Oh, so he learned from his father.
No, his father left home when he was about three and a half. His father was an alcoholic.
Oh, so he learned on his own, but it might have been in his genes or something, right?
You know what you keep in your genes.
As he puts it, quote, "Although I don't have a degree, I've always known people who have needed something electronic done," unquote. As chief maker of the strobe lights and other bread-fetching equipment, Callahan is officially president of Maverick Systems, and electronic manufacturers and distributors occasionally give or lend him instruments that Asko cannot yet afford. They say the thousands of dollars income runs $30,000 per year, mostly from Maverick Systems, a subsidiary in electronic manufacturing. Is that part of your operation, Maverick Systems? If he's president of it?
It's not quite the way it sounds. When Michael joined us, Judy and I were living in Woodstock, and we were spending some time down at the church. Michael moved in with us in Woodstock. He had his own room. Michael and I started, this is before Asko, Maverick Systems, because we were thinking about doing various things. And after we started Asko and spending more and more time at the church, we used Maverick Systems as a thing that we did sell, you know, various kinds of equipment before Intermediate Systems Corporation. And a lot of the things that we were playing around with, Maverick wound up with Intermediate Systems Corporation.
Ah, okay. All right, so it says...
it wasn't really a subsidiary of Asko. I mean, it was a separate little company.
Right.
Yeah.
And...
But we gave it up very early during Asko.
Right, and but it was a way of... You got equipment from manufacturers and then you recycled it.
No, I mean, that had nothing to do with... We could get it as Asko just as easily as Maverick Systems. Seymour Schweber of Schweber Electronics was a friend of ours, and that was how we got a lot of the stuff that we got. So he was very influential in the electronics world.
Right, and would you then do stuff with them and sell them back to people, or...?
No, I mean, equipment would be like test equipment, and you know, like strobe bulbs that we got from Edgerton, and stuff. Most of the stuff that we got, we bought at Surplus, at P&D Surplus, which is near Kingston, and which got all the IBM Surplus from Poughkeepsie and, you know, all the other IBM plants around there. So
well, what did you get income, $30,000 per year, mostly from Maverick Systems? What did you...
It doesn't have to be true.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, the son of an electrician. As chief maker of the... Okay, he's officially president of Maverick Systems. And electronic manufacturers and distributors occasionally give or lend him instruments that USCO cannot yet afford. That's the man you just mentioned, right?
Yes, Seymour Schwaber.
Yeah. The machines and devices he realizes for mixed-media displays are often more intricate than his limited budget would allow a lesser talent. Right?
That's true.
Yeah. Then the last paragraph says, the young producer-consultant John Brockman does so much work with USCO that he is an associate in all but name. And along with Garrett Stern and Michael Callahan, Brockman is co-authoring an introductory textbook on intermedia. Is that the book you guys were going to do up in Cape Cod?
Yep.
And so the book comes out in 69, but you're talking about it 2 years before.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. At one time, anyone was welcome to join USCO, and strangers who can contribute to the current activity win cordial hospitality. Nonetheless, by now, USCO seems more of an example of what can be done. A recognized avant-garde revolutionary elite. And just as their innovations in the arts of media mix have influenced scores of other artists and groups of artists, so USCO itself has become a model for other new American tribes in sync with the electronic age. So Michael Callahan would have something different to say about it. You guys were dupes at the time, in retrospect, right?
Dupes of what?
Of the corporate global USCO mixed media environment that was going to change everything, way beyond what a bunch of artists could influence.
Well, I mean, no, I don't think we were dupes. I mean, we were doing something which pioneered techniques which we didn't realize could be used for much baser rationale.
You weren't conscious dupes. You weren't just that the effects of technology and what was going to happen in this evolution was way beyond what anybody was thinking about at the time.
Yeah, if it hadn't been us, it would have been somebody else.
Yeah. And then in the book, it has, in this booklet that has a picture of the tabernacle and some neat details. Then there's this article from Cheetah Magazine, which is like a pop culture magazine.
Yep.
And I remember Cheetah, so this might be 1968. It says, we are all one. Who are you? And that's spelled capital R, capital U. With light, color, motion, sound, and a little McLuhanist theory, USCO tunes us in on the real vibrational universe. So I won't go into... let me see. I'm going to read the part about McLuhan. She says, in McLuhan's terms, the spectators in that room, and I guess she's probably talking about the Riverside, right? Yeah, she's talking about the Riverside Museum. It's interesting couple of sentences. She says, but collaborations have... No, this is it. Okay. USCO frequently does just part of the thing. For Norman Mailer's Deer Park, USCO devised an elaborate electronic tote board which marked the passage of time and divided acts and scenes with a bell to suggest a boxing ring. As consultants to John Brockman Associates, the group has worked on mixed media sales meetings for Scott Paper Company, a Christmas lighting environment for Henry Bendel's, and the East Coast's first psychedelic discotheque, The World, in Garden City, Long Island. Is that through John Brockman Associates? Is that correct? These ventures... What?
Yeah.
These ventures have provided USCO with a living and a chance to develop and acquire new equipment. but collaborations have drawbacks. The effect of an ESCO production depends to a great extent on the audience's willingness to be drawn in. Ideally, ESCO should control the space, the program, and the viewer's state of mind. When it does, the effect is spectacular, as it was at ESCO's Riverside Museum show, which attracted so much attention that even Life mentioned it in a cover story about psychedelic art. ESCO called it a human being, a coinage popularized by the organizers of the famed San Francisco Gathering of the Tribes, which took place several months later. No, she's saying that you, she's implying you got it from them, but they got it from you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. how could they
popularize it and do something several months later?
Yeah.
The Riverside Bean was an environment where lights, music, painting, sculpture, all the elements invited the viewer to participate, to come in and meditate. This is a long...
Wasn't it more than a couple of months later?
It would be 6 months later.
Yeah.
Yeah, six, almost seven. And here's a new quote from GERD. As spokesman GERD Stern describes it, we wanted a place where people could communicate more with themselves than with anyone else, and in which there was a period of, in John Cage's term, silence. Now, we had a quote earlier where it was not about communicating with oneself, it was about communicating with others. Remember that part?
Yep.
So now the different one. You're being tactile. You're oscillating back and forth. You got them and us and myself and group. ESCO turned one room of the museum into a light garden, where visitors could activate flowers made of lights by walking on floor switches. Inside a second room was a circular enclosure of painted cloth called a cave, because that's where we're all from. We want, quote, that's where we're all from. We wanted to turn people back to their subconscious, unquote. Viewers came into the cave, lay down on a rotating couch, and contemplated the pictures of demons, gods, and humans painted on the ceiling and the walls all around them. A third room was subsequently dubbed the creation, because it sought to encompass the basics of life. It, too, was for meditation. In it were 5 9-foot-high paintings representing the planets in their orbits.
Six.
Okay, five.
Well, I mean, the cave was tie-dyed. There wasn't any images of beings.
Demons, gods,
tie-dyed.
Or humans. It was tie-dyed. In it were 5 9-foot, 6 9-foot-high paintings representing the planets in their orbits, the seven spheres, the tree of life, a male figure of Shiva, Hindu god of energy. His outflowing energy was symbolized by a central pulsating light from which painted lines radiated. A dancing female, the Hindu Shakti, or should that be Shakti? Is it Shakti?
Shiva Shakti.
S-H, she has S-A-K-T-I. The Hindu Shakti represented woman with the light lines radiating out. In the center of the dimly lit room was a sandbox with a rotating light column. It passed the light to the paintings, illuminating them. A dimmer circuit lowered the lights every second minute. The other lights all flashed pulse. Overall was a tape of the original sound of the universe. In McLuhan's terms, the spectators in that room were having a low-definition experience. When individual details are not clearly delineated, the viewer becomes a participant, feeding himself back and forth into what he sees. In Stern's terms, the input was from spectator to experience, from person to painting. Quote, I doubt if one out of 100 people who came to the exhibit saw the dancing Shakti in that painting, says Stern. That doesn't matter, because it worked. That Shakti was out there vibrating in the painting. Who cares if they're arms or legs? They're part of the vibrational universe. Then it says the staff at the Riverside Museum was stunned at the show's reception. A small gallery far off the circuit, its exhibitions were generally more sedate and counted 5 or 6 visitors a day, usually school children and teachers or middle-aged ladies. A crowd. That sentence was actually in another article. Suddenly, ESCO was bringing in teenagers and people in their early 20s and bringing them in by the hundreds. Many brought their lunch, settled down, stayed for the day. Remember that quote from another article? Unless you quoted it in a press release. Stern, who looks a bit like Allen Ginsberg, is ESCO's bearded, bespectacled, long-haired guru. At 38, he has been in, around, and of most of the underground art movements of the last 20 years. He's a Forrest Gump of the mid-20th century scene. That's what I'm saying. He made the beat scene. He was a hippie long before Haight-Ashbury. A founder of Pacifica's first listener-sponsored radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley. He is a poet, in brackets 2 published volumes, a carpenter, he has a union card, a gold mucker, filmmaker, and kinetic sculptor. Then it goes into, she probably used the Richard Castellanos article. Stern was just switching from written to concrete poetry when a friend gave Marshall McLuhan's report to the National Association of Broadcasters, later expanded to Understand Media. McLuhan's stress on the effect of the medium itself rather than its content influenced him enormously. Then Gerd says, quote, it took me on a long jump from poetry to light, sound, and film. Then it goes into meeting Michael and then Steve. It talks about, Stern rarely talks about the belief, they go into the anonymous art thing, their belief in anonymous art and group living as a social mode is conscious and deliberate. Stern rarely talks about it without reference to Marshall McLuhan or Amando Kumaraswamy. Amando Kumaraswamy, an Italian. No, I'm saying. Former curator of the Boston Museum. They agree with McLuhan that with television and electronic tribalization, the world has shrunk to the dimensions of a global village. Then you say, quote, Gerd says, we're going back to the more traditional society. That's not true. Where the craftsman does his work, and never mind what his name is. See, the digital environment makes everybody hyper-individualistic. That's what was really coming. If you went to Chartres when they were building the cathedral cistern, you wouldn't be likely to look up and say, hey, that's Charlie, you did that gargoyle on the left. On the other hand, he adds, we don't go around saying no name. We don't go around saying no names, no names, no names. Then it goes into the church. Anywhere from 6 to 30 members of the Esco family drift between Garnerville and Woodstock, New York, and Taos, New Mexico. Woodstock is the site of Maverick Systems, a company which Michael Callahan runs for manufacturing Esco's hardware. Is that true? Is that accurate?
More or less true.
Oh, then it says, at the moment, Esco is working out another corporation scheme with a group of Harvard Business School students and professors who want to market some of Esco's equipment. Now, that's the intermediate thing.
Yes.
I just want to read the very first paragraph, which is interesting. This is by a woman named Naomi Fiegelson. You remember that name?
Fiegelson, yes. She's a poet and a writer, yeah.
Okay.
I think she's still around.
Okay. It starts off, a continuous flow of images projected on the theater's cave-like walls assaults the audience. Now that's it. Finding his wake on one level begins in the caveman zone. So it's interesting, redoing Finding his wake in many ways. A continuous flow of images projected on the theater's cave-like walls assaults the audience. Flowers, larger than life, open and closed, zooming in and out. The eyes, lips, face, and shoulder of Jean Harlow. Penguins, eagles, birds of prey, a volcano erupting. On the screen up front, a lion licks her cub. Over all this is a mixture of sound. Animals roaring, Eleanor Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, music from Bach, Tristan, and Gone with the Wind. In the semi-darkness, three musicians walk up to the stage with Yahrzeit candles, sit a while in the light of the remembered dead, and sing about energy and love. They leave, and the play Michael McClure's The Beard begins. So the beard was part of this.
No, not part of it. The beard was a production all by itself.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
At the Evergreen Theater in New York, and the three musicians were the prologue. The media was all around the room, the projections, in the theater.
In the theater when the beard was presented?
It was the beard. That was the only thing that was represented. We did the media by and large.
For the beard?
Yeah.
Right. And so, but are there an excerpt of the beard is in the Riverside Museum? That's what
No, nothing to do with the museum.
Oh, okay, because she says they leave.
A different trip entirely, different time.
Right, because she writes, they leave, the three musicians, and the play, Michael McClure's The Beard, begins. That's not accurate.
Yes, the three musicians were the prologue of The Beard.
Oh, and they just did the prologue part in the Riverside Museum.
No. Who said anything about Riverside Museum?
Okay, I'm assuming she's describing what was going on
No, she wasn't. She was describing what's going on at the Evergreen.
At the Beard.
Theater.
Oh, okay. So she's describing all this. This is the Beard, the beginning of it.
Yes.
Okay. The prologue and theater design are by Esco, for Us Company, a group of artists who live as a family and work in intermedia and environmental art. Combining Lights, colors, moving images, sounds, and often human actors, Intermedia is the end product of half a century of under and above ground art. It shows the influence of psychedelic drugs, pop art, op art, junk art, kinetic sculpture, light sculpture, electronic music, and happenings. It has absorbed the perfumes of Oriental mysticism and the precepts of Buckminster Fuller, who emphasizes man's relation to environment, and Marsh McLuhan, who describes technology as man's extension in time and space. The prologue for The Beard, which lasted a full 35 minutes, excited responses ranging from delight and receptivity to boredom and even outrage. This was not too different from the effect of the play itself. During the pre-opening previews, producer Jim Walsh reported some anger in the audience during the prologue and occasional walkouts. At least one viewer asked if there was really going to be a play. She was afraid the prologue was, quote, the whole thing. Usko frequently does just part of the thing. For Norman Mailer's Deer Park,
yeah.
And then we went into that. Oh, that's neat. That was a description of The Beard. I didn't notice that. Okay, now, there's an article by Judd Yalcott on Intermedia. I think it's, well, I'm not sure. But I just have to switch phones here for a second. Mine's starting to blip out just a second. Okay. All right. So, this is an article. Beg your pardon?
What weren't you sure about?
It's an article by Judd Yalcott, your
yes.
colleague. Was he a member of USCO?
Yes.
Okay. So this is for Arts Magazine, May 67. So this is a year after the Riverside Museum.